Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We have a very, very honored guest today. We are going to be speaking with Cindy Corey. Cindy is the mother of Rachel Corey, the young activist involved in the international solidarity movement, who was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer as she was trying to protect the home of a Palestinian in the Gaza Strip. Cindy, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so nice to have you on. I know we've wanted to have you on for quite a while, but you've been just terribly busy lately, haven't you?
It's been an interesting year. We were in Israel for much of last year with a civil trial in Rachel's case that was really spread throughout the year. And recently we've been in Turkey for a week where the play My Name is Rachel Corey was performed in Turkish, and we were able to visit the Mavi Marmara, which is the ship that was part of the flotilla that was attacked last May.
Well, I'm sure most of my listeners are very well aware of what happened to your daughter, Rachel, in 2003, but in case there's somebody who's listening that doesn't know, can you just tell us briefly what happened to her?
Rachel traveled to Gaza in January of 2003 with the International Solidarity Movement, which continues. It's a group that continues to function with internationals traveling to the West Bank and Gaza to stand in solidarity with Palestinians who are nonviolently resisting the occupation there. And Rachel was there for 7 weeks in Rafah, which is at the southernmost part of the Gaza Strip. It borders on Egypt. And there were a tremendous number of house demolitions going on. This was during the Second Intifada. The Israeli military was clearing a wide buffer zone along what they called the Philadelphia Corridor, and there was home demolition was just part of the assault on the people that was taking place at that time. And one of the things that she did was to join with other internationals to try to prevent those demolitions. And on March 16th, 2003, she was with seven other internationals from the United States and from the UK. They had been in the area all afternoon once they discovered that there were two Israeli military bulldozers. They were actually made by Caterpillar Corporation here in the United States. But these two bulldozers in an APC vehicle working in the area. And they would stand and with their banners and with Rachel was wearing an orange reflective jacket, as was at least one or two other activists that were there, and they thought they'd been successful actually late in the afternoon because the bulldozers retreated to the border area, to the Philadelphia Corridor area. They had come off of that before towards the homes. And they had called back to their coordinator to say that they thought that they had maybe, prevented any activity towards the houses that were still standing in that area that day. But then they returned, and within 5 minutes after the bulldozers came back to the area, Rachel stood in front of one that was headed towards a house in which two families lived, the Nasrallah family, two brothers, an accountant and a pharmacist. She knew there were five children behind the wall that she was standing in front of. The family members were all gathered actually watching the bulldozer activity behind this wall. And on that run, the bulldozer continued forward. It didn't stop as it had done previously when it had come close to the activist. It continued forward. It ran over Rachel. According to eyewitness testimony, it then stopped and then backed over her again. And her friends, of course, went to her immediately. She was able to say to them, "I think my back is broken," but those were her last words, and she died shortly after.
Oh, Cindy, thank you for recounting that. I know that that's not easy to do, having a child that was killed also. But There's, of course, Israel cleared itself in Rachel's death, saying that the bulldozer driver did not see her. I read accounts from eyewitnesses that said it would have been impossible not to see her because she climbed up on a pile of rubble, and she was clearly visible to the driver. Do you think that this was an intentional thing to scare the activists away or to punish them for standing up to the government of Israel?
Well, certainly, you know, our journey for this past 8 years has been to try to discover the truth about everything that happened that day, and we're still engaged in that process. But what we do know, and my husband went to Vietnam, and he said that, you know, when Rachel left to go to Gaza, he didn't talk about it a lot. I think he had more anxiety than I did because of his own experience in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
But he said he always, you know, he thought about Rachel, who was this tall young woman, but light, not a heavy person. He always thought soldiers could pick her up and remove her from some uh-huh. protest or demonstration if they wanted to. But then once he heard about the kinds of things that were happening there, where there was shooting into the homes of families where children lived, and we've seen those houses. We actually saw the house that Rachel stood in front of before it was finally demolished, and it was covered with bullet holes, as were all the houses that faced that border. When he saw about that, when he heard about some of the things that were happening, when the activists and workers who were trying to repair wells would have shots fired near mm-hmm. their feet, that then he realized that there was an army that was really out of control there. And we've since heard statements from Break the Silence soldiers, who are Israeli soldiers who are speaking out about their own actions in Gaza and in the West Bank, and have written about it, have talked about these things, and they talk about the things that they did, that when once they get back home, they realize what was wrong with that kind of behavior. In Rachel's case, she was not the only international who was fatally injured in that area. Within 7 weeks, two people from the UK, Tom Herndahl and James Miller. Tom was also with ISM. He had only been there a week. And James Miller was an HBO photojournalist doing a documentary on the home demolitions. Both of them were killed within 2 miles of where Rachel was killed within 7 weeks. And the British actually looked at it. They had coroner's inquest, and they uh-huh. combined those because they said when you have that number of killings, it indicates that there's some systemic problem with what's
right.
happening. I believe, you know, certainly it was a military out of control. I believe that the investigation that was promised to the United States, which our country says, our government says, that the investigation that was done by the Israelis was inadequate and remains inadequate. And what we're learning in court is just how really poor that investigation was and what the attitudes are of some of the people who were involved in that. I do think, too, that they wanted very much to clear that border strip. One of the I believe it was a general, but at least a high-level commander, stated on Israeli military radio that he didn't. He thought it was just taking too long, that they had to destroy more and more rows of houses in order to take over more area mm-hmm. there. So I think that the activists were interfering with their intentions, and even though these were illegal actions against a civilian population, the Israeli military did decide to, you know, try to oppose it. And I think the climate allowed for the kinds of things that happened to Rachel and James and Tom and to hundreds of Palestinians at the same time.
Well, speaking of the climate, when Rachel was killed, it was just days before the shock and awe of the United States against Iraq. And I read where Rachel was protesting that eventuality when she was over in Gaza. But what response did you get from the Bush administration when this happened, and what response have you sought a response from the Obama administration seeking justice for your daughter's death or justice against the people who caused it? Tell me about those two things.
Well, the day after Rachel was killed, President Bush, we know, did speak by telephone to Prime Minister Sharon about what had happened to Rachel. And he was promised a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. We pursued accountability on the part of our own government because they say, and what was said at the time Rachel was killed, is that the American government, the State Department, the embassies, that they consider it one of their most important responsibilities to find out what happened in cases like these when Americans mm-hmm. are injured. So what we've done, I think our family, and with a lot of help from people around the country who've spoken to members of Congress and so forth, is to try to hold our own government to that standard. And we've had some success. There are certainly things that the U.S. government, that positions that they've taken, and certainly positions that individuals have taken, that have been helpful to us and have made it possible for us to move ahead on this. But I think, and most people who do this kind of work would understand, that we've had to really work hard for every step that we've taken, for every bit of support that we've gotten. It isn't really as though the government sets out to try to make situations like this right. It depends a lot on the amount of advocacy that families do and that their supporters do. One of the best things that happened for us was that Colin Powell's chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, met with us in 2003. And he, when we wrote to him later about the Israeli investigation in Rachel's case, he sent a letter to us in writing saying that he could say without equivocation that the investigation that had been done did not meet the standard of being thorough, credible, and transparent. And others at the State Department and the American Embassy have put that into writing. Most recently, when Vice President Biden was a senator and a part of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he did submit a question about Rachel's case to the current ambassador to Israel from the United States, James Cunningham, and he asked about the investigation and what had happened. And at that time, Cunningham responded in his confirmation hearings that he would continue to work on the case, and that, in fact, the position of the State Department had not changed, that there had not been a good investigation. So, and we have talked with officials high in the Obama administration at the State Department, and we've had meetings with some of Vice President Biden's staff. So I guess the good news is that we have we do feel somewhat supported. We do feel like we're able to talk to people there about our concerns, not just about Rachel's case, but about the situation in Gaza, about policies of the U.S. government. The difficult news is again that no matter what we seem to do, it's a very slow process, and that we're still looking for accountability.
Right. And speaking of that, you said that you were recently in Turkey and you visited, I don't know, the surviving members of the Mavi Marmara or the ship, or I'm not clear exactly who you visited from the Mavi Marmara, but it's kind of a similar case where, Israel used excessive force, killed many people, and then vindicated itself. So how are the activists there feeling in Turkey?
It was an amazing visit for us. We were there less than a week, and we went because the play, My Name is Rachel Corrie, was being performed in Turkish by an actress we had met about a year and a half or so ago in Oregon. She's mm-hmm. Turkish, but she studied at the Oregon State University in Corvallis, and her theater teacher had done the play there with a different actress, but this young Turkish actress came to see it. Setana is her name, and she at that time she had already gotten the rights to translate the play into Turkish, and she asked us then if she did it, if she was able to perform it, if we would come to Turkey then, and we said we would. It turned out to be a really kind of challenging time for us because of all our time in Israel this past mm-hmm. year, but we were able to make that journey. And I think what was really amazing to us was to see the response in Istanbul. We were in Istanbul the entire time, but there was amazing interest in Rachel's story and in our coming, I think, because a lot of it relates to the Mavi Marmara.
Uh-huh.
And we went to visit the ship. It did come back from Israel. It was in dry dock being repaired. Parts of it had been the electronic systems and so forth had been intentionally damaged, according to the captain of the ship that we talked with. So they're making repairs. They plan for it to sail again. It was amazing to me. It was high up, and I have acrophobia. It was kind of a mm-hmm. challenge with heights, and it was a 7-flight stair, I think, uh-huh. to get up to the top. So I sat at the bottom of it uh-huh. and just reflected on it. And it was very emotional to think about over 600 very courageous people that took that journey. And then, of course, what transpired once they were in international waters and were attacked and 9 people were killed.
Right.
One of those people was an American citizen. His name is Furkan Dogan.
Uh-huh.
And he doesn't He's not a dual citizenship. There's been some confusion about that he also has Turkish citizenship, but he doesn't. And we met with his father, who will be visiting the U.S. soon, and they're very concerned about the fact that people in the United States do not know the story of this 18-year-old young man who made the journey because of his compassion for people in Gaza
uh-huh.
and was shot multiple times.
Right.
And also, we met with we had a really good quiet time with some other family members who lost their fathers on board the ship. Who one woman who was on the Mavi Marmara, her husband was killed, and so we had time to sit and be with them. And I know, Cindy, how important just that time together with people who share your experience, something of your experience
yes.
is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I just think that the people there connect to Rachel's story because they know that the story of those who are on the Mavi Marmara is the same one. And so to us, it was really meaningful to be there. And over 200, I think 200 or 300,000 people visited that ship in 1 week
wow.
after it returned from Israel. So without a doubt, it figures very strongly in the hearts of Turkish people.
What is the status of the Irish ship, the Rachel Corrie, that also attempted to break the blockade?
I haven't been in direct contact. I guess I think it's been returned now to mm-hmm. Ireland, and we have friends who are Irish activists. We weren't involved in really, making that ship happen. It was certainly friends of ours,
right.
International Solidarity Movement activists, and people like Mairead Corrigan, who Nobel Peace Prize
right.
winner.
She's been on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox before.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and they've made it happen. My understanding is that the ship has that it has been returned. I hope that's the case, but I don't know for sure.
Are you involved at all in the ship that wants to sail from the United States and funding it?
We're really supportive. We have friends who will be on board because of the fact that our lawsuit is continuing in Israel. It puts us in a challenging position to be able to do that. And also, we still don't know. At this point, we haven't had word about when our next court dates will be. There was a strike. State's attorneys went on strike in November and December for over 40 days. So there's a huge backlog in their courts, as I understand it. We had thought we were going to have court dates at the end of December, and those were canceled. And we still haven't had new court dates rescheduled. So it makes things pretty unpredictable for us. But because of the fact that people who have been on these trips, they've really been deported and not allowed to return to Israel, and we
right.
need to be able to return for court, so that's limited
right.
our ability to actually be on board, but we're very supportive of the people who are, again, stepping up to do this.
Well, what's the status of your case against the IDF in Israel? And
there are six state witnesses that
mm-hmm.
remain to testify. The court system is different than it is here in the United States. There are no juries. As far as I understand, there are never juries. Everything is heard by a judge. And I think in some ways we didn't anticipate the impact that this would have on our case, because we're accustomed to jury trials. I've been on a couple of juries
mm-hmm.
here in Washington
mm-hmm.
State. But what happens is that a judge is dealing with many different proceedings at the same time. And when we went in March of 2010, our expectation was that we would present our witnesses and then the state would call its witnesses and that it would all end at that point, at least that part of the testimony. But almost immediately before we were to leave, we learned that the judge had granted the state a motion to not have to name their witnesses even until after our witnesses testified.
Wow.
They were granted 30 days to do that, and then that was extended for another 30 days. Then the judge went on a sabbatical, and then there was a summer recess. We returned in September, and I think there were two court dates in September, two in October, and or maybe three in October and another couple in November. And the way that this works is witnesses submit an affidavit with their initial testimony to the court, and that becomes sworn testimony. And then the opposing attorney gets to question the witness that presented that affidavit. And the period that we're in right now is that the state's witnesses have been testifying, and our attorney has been able to question them, and it's been very informing. I mean, sometimes what we hear is that they don't remember anything,
mm-hmm.
We've also heard some very startling things, and I'm happy that there have been two people from the American Embassy at each proceeding,
mm-hmm.
and also observers from Human Rights Watch, from the Center for Constitutional Rights, National Lawyers Guild, at various times have all had representatives there. And a couple of the most startling things, one came from a high-level official who actually wrote the manual about how heavy equipment was to be used during the Second Intifada. It had all
uh-huh.
been oral. And he stated, and he was a colonel, stated that there are no civilians in war.
Wow.
Which, you know, everybody was flabbergasted.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when I talk about how I think what happens is that we're exposing kind of the mentality of how, you know, just of overall the mentality of some people who are dictating what goes on. The chief investigator in Rachel's case, who still is the head of special investigations for the military police, said he believed that they were at war with everyone, including the peace activist. And this is the guy who was supposed to provide some kind of impartial look at what happened to Rachel that day.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing about this being a civil case is that it's not against one soldier. Mm-hmm. We did hear from the driver of the bulldozer and the commander, who was also in the bulldozer, who was to be an extra set of eyes. And they were behind a screen. We weren't able to see them, which was disconcerting. I think it served to really dehumanize them in mm-hmm. ways that I wish hadn't happened. But they, but the case is against the Israeli government and the Ministry of Defense. So it's really looking at that entire system and challenging that. And since we're able to do that, that's what we feel we need to do.
So just a like a logistical question, I travel a lot, I travel all over the world. Where do you stay when you're in Israel? How are you treated? You know, it must kind of be, you know, a little bit of a relief to have, you know, State Department officials there, even though, you know, I wouldn't trust them that much. But where do you stay? How are you treated by the people of Israel?
Well, you know, we've traveled to Gaza 4 times. We've been in the West Bank I don't know how many times, and in Israel before. But this, definitely this past year, is the longest period of time that we've actually spent in Israel, you know, the Israel proper, I guess. But it's been, in some ways, it was very enlightening for us, because I think while we're very aware of the situation for Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, we knew less about the situation for Palestinians who are citizens of Israel.
Right.
Over 20% are.
Mm-hmm.
And our attorney is a Palestinian Israeli, our lead attorney. The trial is in Haifa, which is in the northern part of Israel. It's mm-hmm. it's a beautiful place. It's on the Mediterranean.
Right.
It's built high on the hills of Carmel. It's you can see Lebanon in the distance. It's in a lot of ways, it's kind of a magical place. As far as the people are concerned, I feel, and I imagine that you find this too, I feel so fortunate, because people gravitate, you know, people who support us gravitate
yes.
to us. And there were, the first day we went to court, there were Jewish Israelis from Haifa and from elsewhere in Israel who came and stood outside the court with signs of support. And Palestinians, of course, who came to support us. And on the day that the driver testified, the state that day, it wasn't a huge courtroom, and there was a lot of media interest, and people knew that this was going to be a difficult day for us.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got there about 45 minutes to an hour ahead of time, the state clearly had tried to pack the courtroom, because it was nearly, I'd say, over half, maybe two-thirds full of people in uniform. At first I thought, well, maybe these are friends of the soldiers who are going to testify, and then I realized, no, they didn't know that soldier at all. It was just that the state had brought these people in, and they had never done that before. But what happened is that some of the media were kept outside the court. It created kind of a scene outside. I think it would have been interesting. One of my friends said he wanted to stay outside and to write about all the connections that were made outside in the hall that day.
Mm-hmm.
But when we came out from the sessions a couple hours later, our Israeli friends were still there, because they wanted us to know, you know, that they were there in solidarity with what we were doing. So I feel, you know, I don't go walking around advertising who I
right.
am particularly or anything, but I feel secure there, and we've had tremendous support from really good people who are working together to try to change the situation.
I just have one last question, because we are running out of time, and so many times people, you know, especially people hostile to what I do, they say that, you know, my grief has driven me crazy, and I won't, you know, stop doing what I'm doing, and I need to stop, and I need to grieve my son's death, like as if I don't do that every second of every day anyway. And how are you and Craig and your family holding up, and how do you think this really this quest for justice and peace that has taken over your life since Rachel died, how do you think that has affected your grief process?
Well, those are really good questions. I think it's hard to know the answers exactly.
Right.
But I remember that there was a time. I love the outdoors. We live in a beautiful place in the Northwest, but when mm-hmm. Rachel was killed, we lived in North Carolina. And I remember driving through the mountains of North Carolina after she was killed and wondering if things would ever look as beautiful to me ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, and I trust that this has probably happened for you, I hope it's happened for you, at some point I realized that they did, you know, mm-hmm. that once again I could look at all of the beauty in the world and appreciate it for myself, not simply feel sad that Rachel wasn't there to enjoy it as well. And so somehow all that color came back for me. And I think it came back because of the fact that there's so much work to do. And
right.
That she led me to that work. I would rather have her here. You would rather have
yeah.
Casey here. We would do anything to have those children physically back in our lives.
Yeah.
But I know they are in our lives every moment of every day. We think about them every hour. And they're very much with us. But I think they also left us with opportunity. And sometimes I think, you know, Rachel would be ticked off that I'm having some of the opportunities that I do to meet people. You know, why isn't she here doing that?
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have the opportunity. And I know, I'm sure you find, too, that other young people, I love reaching out and talking to young people because they're questioning what to do with their own lives. And I feel like there's so many places where we get to share, some of our concerns about the world, but we also get to help people find their own paths, to support them in making their own journeys. And I just feel very privileged to be able to do that and so appreciative of all the support that makes it possible.
And I, after this interview, I'm going to get in my car and drive an hour and a half and talk to a club, a high school club that's called Peace in the Middle East. And so if there's one thing you'd like to pass on to them, what would that be?
Oh,
because they'll be thrilled
great.
To know I talked to you.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I would just say to them, you know, it's kind of Rachel's message that in your lives you still want to have fun. She said, I still want to have boyfriends and dance around to Pat Benatar, but I want this to stop. I want what's happening in Gaza to stop. And I don't think it's, it's not a crazy thing for us to just all stop what we're doing and try to take some step to make the world better. And I think we're seeing amazing things right now with what's happening in Egypt and
right.
in the Middle East. And I think that speaks to the fact that as individuals, even, you know, the smallest things that we do are cumulative. You know, we don't operate in a vacuum. And I like youth to know that those small steps that they make really do make a difference.
And Cindy Corey, mother of Rachel Corey, how can my listeners support your work, support you,
Well, thank you for asking.
Any way that you need to be supported.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I have to say that we get a lot of messages that really lift our spirits all the time. I would encourage people to go to the website. We have a website, rachelcoreyfoundation.org. And we have a conference coming up that people, volunteers and friends, people here in Olympia, Washington, are putting together for April. It will be focusing, it's called Solidarity in Action, and we'll be focusing a lot on boycott, divestment, and sanctions and why we need to be moving in that direction. And Alice Walker is going to come to speak, so people might be able to join us there, but certainly at the website they can find out ways to support us.
Well, Cindy Corey, it was great talking to you, and thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thanks, Cindy, for your work, for all you do, and have fun with those kids.
Okay. Talk to you soon, I hope.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was our guest, Cindy Corey. What a moving and special interview that was for me. So thank you for listening, and I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, you for listening, and Cindy for being our guest. I hope you tune in next week. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.